foreign policy challenges facing the U.S. today. The United States faces foreign policy challenges all over the globe. Just look at the headlines. A Florida-based doctor has been arrested as a key suspect in the assassination of Haiti's prime minister. The top U.S. general in Afghanistan will step down today in advance of the U.S. troop withdrawal. President Biden is demanding Putin crack down on Russian cyber criminals. China claims it drove a U.S. warship from the South China Sea. Plus, Israel has a new leader, and the new incoming leader of Iran says he will not discuss the nuclear deal. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss these stories and more with leading global analyst and author Aaron David Miller. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. From Haiti to Afghanistan to China, President Biden is facing complicated foreign policy challenges. Today, we will discuss the Biden administration's foreign policy objectives with Aaron David Miller. He is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a global affairs analyst for CNN and other major news outlets. He's the author of many books. His most recent, The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Aaron, thank you so much, and welcome back to Maine Calling.
Jennifer, it's a pleasure to be here, however virtually, although I'm looking forward maybe next week in coming to Maine for several weeks.
Wonderful. We invite your questions and comments. You in the audience, email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Aaron, let's start, instead of talking about one specific part of the world in the beginning, let's talk about overall foreign policy. Is there a Biden doctrine? Is it too early to say? Is there a distinctive shift from what we've had before?
You know, 6 months in, it's clear that there is a distinctive shift. Both, I would argue, from Mr. Biden's predecessor, but also from one of Mr. Biden's good friends and former boss, Barack Obama. The Biden foreign policy is clearly closer, both in terms of its emphasis on human rights and values and leadership and multilateral diplomacy to Barack Obama's. But there is a certain measure of continuity as well from the Trump administration. I think that continuity is best demonstrated in the fact that if you ask Joe Biden how to get American foreign policy right, I think his answer would be, get America right. And while Biden and Trump have fundamentally different views, the one is the antipode from the other about what it means to get America right, Biden would argue to you, I think, that there's no single foreign policy challenge out there or combination of foreign policy challenges that are more dangerous to his presidency and more detrimental to the future of this republic than the three or four interlocked crises that we face at home. And that argues for a foreign policy that is disciplined, prudent, to a large degree risk averse, and focused largely on two issues, promoting American security and American prosperity. One last point, just to set the stage. You know, governing is about choosing. Franklin Roosevelt reportedly said about Lincoln, our undeniably greatest president. That's one great president remarking on the behavior of an undeniably great president, Lincoln, that Lincoln died a sad man because he couldn't have everything. Governing is about choosing. And in this case, this president is faced with the greatest challenge of national recovery of any American president since Franklin Roosevelt. Without, I might add, the large majorities in the House and Senate that both Roosevelt needed and enjoyed, and that Lyndon Baines Johnson needed and enjoyed in order to secure transformative change at home. So my read is Biden would like to be a transformational president at home and is willing to be a smart and effective one abroad.
Let me ask you this. I think a lot of people will understand this philosophy that to actually have influence, America needs to get, the U.S. needs to get its own house in order. On the other hand, isn't a risk-averse foreign policy, wouldn't that open the door to bad actors?
Well, that's bad actors, unfortunately, are a permanent feature of the international system. And COVID-19, probably the most world-altering event since the Second World War, has not so much fundamentally changed the world, but reinforced pre-existing trends in which a number of American adversaries, principally China and Russia, but not only, have capitalized. I think the world is less well-suited in many respects for the kind of American primacy and dominance that we've enjoyed at various points, not always, but at very various points over the last 70 years. Remember, the last war that left America stronger at home with more influence abroad was World War II. And I think that essentially drives the point that risk aversion when it comes to projecting American military power abroad has not been a source of presidential strength for any of the wars that we have waged, frankly, since the end of the Second World War. Bad actors, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, I think have capitalized on the fact, yes, that to some degree America has retrenched, but it's also capitalized on the fact that the world is not nearly, European allies perhaps, but the world is not nearly as accommodating or as respectful or as admiring of American power as it has been at certain moments in our history. And that is largely a result, I think, of what's occurred here, not just over the past 4 years, but perhaps over the last 20, where our own democratic principles and values and institutions, our effectiveness to be the can-do people, to solve problems. I mean, after all, COVID was the greatest threat to the planet, as I mentioned, arguably since the Second World War. And yes, vaccines were produced, but our capacity to lead on COVID, to deal with our own broken house on COVID, was fundamentally compromised, as many democracies around the world struggled with it as well. But also in the department of leading on COVID, we're only lately getting around to understand that unless you vaccinate the world, or at least try to do so, you're not going to beat COVID. And that has economic and political consequences, which are quite negative for America's influence in the world.
I do want to talk about U.S. foreign policy challenges in specific areas of the world. We're lucky to have calling in right now Ambassador Pamela White. Ambassador White has been ambassador to Haiti, and I know, thank you so much for calling in. I know, Ambassador White, you still are very connected to that country and are following the events there incredibly closely. This morning, as the news unfolds that a Florida-based doctor is now a chief suspect, I want to hear your reaction, and what do you think is going on? What precipitated the assassination?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Thanks for having me on. Nice to be with you again. That's a million-dollar question. I don't think anybody knows. I don't know this doctor in Miami, but they're just going to have to, you know, unpeel this onion little by little, like they're doing all investigations. And the United States has sent down some experts to help them, go through this very long, complicated process. But my friend Haiti, I've spent many late nights talking to them, and this morning, and no one believes they're at the core of this thing yet.
Wow. Ambassador White, I know that there's much unrest in Haiti right now. The Haitian people have asked for American troops. Do you believe that President Biden ought to send American troops to Haiti?
I really don't. I've never quite thought that was the answer, because it prolongs what I think is the solution, and the solution is not having American troops there at this time. I would support a real uptake in a program that we ran when I was there, and that was at the Miami PD and the New York PD. We had several hundreds of my time there, excellent, fabulous officers come to Haiti, and they were, most of them were Haitian descent and spoke the language, spoke Creole. They were excellent, and they trained with the police, and they made sure that they were correctly uniformed and had the right equipment and followed them. And and by the time I left, the police force was very much respected in Haiti. Unfortunately, that program under the former administration got completely gutted and is no longer there. But I think a rapid escalation of that program would be a very good thing, so that the Haitians are actually, you know, standing up security on their own.
Ambassador White, as you know, we have Aaron David Miller on the program with us. And Aaron, I wanted to give you a chance to ask Ambassador White a question. What are you wondering as you watch events unfold in Haiti?
You know, Ambassador White's going to forget more about Haiti than I'm ever going to know. But I would agree 100% with her RX here, her prescription, when it comes to Haiti. I mean, look at the situation in Afghanistan. We are in the process of undertaking a very painful decision, which is going to create huge political implications, I suspect, as the pictures of what happens post-withdrawal in Afghanistan, and they're going to be ugly, come floating back to the United States. But Afghanistan is a failed state. Haiti, I don't know if whether it was Ambassador White referred to Haiti as an aid state, in the sense that it's become a ward of the international community. But the notion that we would jump into a situation, we did this, as Ambassador White knows, in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
It was not very successful. I mean, you could probably make the argument that with the best of intentions, that U.S. involvement in ignoring Haiti's civil society from the bottom up and backing strong leaders, corrupt, nepotistic leaders from the top down, has been demonstrated that we're not part of the solution, but part of the problem.
Yep, 1,000% agree.
Ambassador White, what will you be watching the next days and weeks, and what do you see as the best possible outcome at this point? I understand three different people claim to be rightful prime minister.
That's true. I mean, the good news about those three is that they have agreed to talk, and they have been talking. They were talking yesterday. They talked with the group of from NSC and Justice and the Department of State that went down as consultants yesterday. The three of them were in the same room at the same time, and they've sort of agreed to. I'm not exactly sure who's going to, you know, take the reins, but all three of them will be playing a role going forward. The doctor, the neurosurgeon, Henri, is a very highly respected, both in the medical world and also in the political world. He's held political positions before and is considered to be relatively or very, I don't know, depending on your view, corrupt, and someone that many, many people in Haiti respect. My biggest problem going forward is exactly what was just expressed, and that is, how do we hear the people's voices? We cannot continue to listen to the elite, the business elite or the political elite, and not go down into the streets and start listening to what the people really want. They've been demonstrating for well over a year. Crime is crazy. Kidnapping is crazy. The deaths have taken over. And we have got to figure out a solution, not if the United States of America imposes on Haiti, which we love to do all over the world, which, you know, sometimes is the easy way out, in my opinion. But this is going to be tough. We're going to take our time. We're going to have to help them come up with solutions to their own problems. I think it can be done. Tomorrow I'm talking with some women leaders that I'm hoping will give me their inside views of what maybe next steps could be taken. but it's going to have to be a slow, ponderous process. Development is not easy. It's hard. There are no easy solutions, and any quick fixes are not going to work.
Well, Ambassador White, thank you so much for calling in. That's Ambassador Pamela White. She is former ambassador to Haiti, and she is a Mainer. Thanks so much, Ambassador White.
And
we look, that's right. We look forward to hearing from you more, and hopefully at some point in the future, some good news out of Haiti. Thank you so much for calling in. Aaron, I want to turn, you mentioned Afghanistan, and I would say that this may possibly be the most controversial decision that President Biden has made in terms of foreign policy so far, withdrawing troops, first the date September 11th, now earlier. Today, the general who is not happy about this decision, General Austin Scott Miller, stepping down. Many, many people worried about the fate of the Afghan people. However, it's been 20 years.
It has been, and you could to some degree, although Iraq, our initial operations in Afghanistan in the fall of 2001 was not a discretionary war. The United States was attacked by Al-Qaeda, given sanctuary by the Taliban. It was imperative that the U.S. respond. It was imperative that the U.S. Try to weaken, if not destroy, Al-Qaeda. Secure a measure of justice for the 2,700 plus Americans who were killed on that day, with respect to bringing Osama bin Laden to justice. But you ended up with mission creep, serious objective inflation, and we rapidly morphed to a situation in which we sought not to do counterterrorism, but as a part of the counterterrorism mission to try to break an insurgency and create a sort of new political governing reality, government in a box, if you will, in Afghanistan. And it is simply impossible for me, without trivializing the sacrifices, the ultimate sacrifices of the men and women who died in Afghanistan, and those Afghans, and thousands of Americans who received life-crushing injuries from which they will never recover. Hard to justify our investment based on the returns. Afghanistan became a discretionary campaign, not a war or a campaign of necessity, but of choice. It in the end became a $1 trillion social science experiment. And it promised so much more than it delivered. It promised economic reconstruction. It promised a measure of democratic reform. It promised women's rights. It promised a better life for the majority of the Afghan people. Most of those objectives have fallen flat. And the majority of Afghans remain poor and disenfranchised. You know, while kleptocratic elites scramble to maintain their privilege in Kabul. There was never a good time to withdraw, and I would argue never a good way to withdraw. We have a central national interest of doing counterterrorism there post-withdrawal. That's going to be harder now, but at the same time, the threat from Al-Qaeda diminished. I would only make the point, Jennifer, that needs to be made repeatedly. And that is, we invested billions, trillions of dollars in the wake of 9/11, understandably, given what happened to us on that fateful day. But in essence, when the real threat to the Republic came, it didn't come from jihadi terror. It came from a virus, which has now killed and counting more Americans that have died in World War II, Korea and Vietnam combined. In essence, the virus was 200 9/11s. And I'm not arguing we shouldn't emphasize counterterrorism. We need to protect the homeland. But our priorities, I think, arguably, not so arguably, were seriously out of whack. It was a tough decision.
And this from a foreign policy expert.
Tough decision. None of Biden's predecessors were willing, you could argue, or able to take that decision. Biden did. the public opinion polls, I saw a Pew poll indicating 60%+ of the American public agrees with the decision. And I would argue most outside of those who are related to those who served, and many veterans clearly think this was the right decision as well. Most Americans are much more understandably focused on their own economic security, prosperity, and the fate of this republic at home. It's another cautionary tale why we should not, and Ambassador White is 100% right, think about deploying American forces into Haiti.
We are speaking with global analyst Aaron David Miller. We'd love to have you join the conversation. What are you thinking about as you watch global affairs? 1-800-399-3566. If you'd like, send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org and find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Downeast Acadia, inviting you to discover ancestral skills and outdoor traditions at the Puckerbrush Primitive Gathering this weekend. TrueMaine.net. By Ocean View at Falmouth, with the goal of promoting optimal health through active retirement living. OceanViewRC.com. And by Champlain College Online, helping New Englanders prepare for what's next. Champlain.edu/New England.
We'll get the latest read on inflation come Tuesday, but the way we measure housing inflation, it's probably not what you'd expect.
That's where we have to ask this question. If you were to rent your house, how much could it rent for?
Oh, yeah. My answer definitely to that one's going to be higher than it should be. I'm Kai Rizdahl. How we keep track of housing prices next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace today at 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. The 24th Maine International Film Festival is underway in Waterville, Skowhegan, and online. The festival features the best of American independent and international cinema and spotlights some of Maine and New England's most innovative filmmakers. Maine Public is a media sponsor of this year's festival, and Maine Public members are eligible for a special discount on tickets. For details on the Maine International Film Festival and the Maine Public member discount, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about the Biden administration and its approach to foreign policy and the challenges around the globe today. My guest, Aaron David Miller, who is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He is a global affairs analyst, an author of many books, and someone you've probably seen on television. Share your comments or questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or join our conversation by phone, 1-800-399-3566. Looking at a list of what we have not yet gotten to, Aaron, and let's go to Russia. President Biden over the weekend demanding that Vladimir Putin crack down on these Russian cyber criminals. Is it even clear that this is a group that's separate from the government in Russia?
Well, when it comes to, look, Vladimir Putin is a former FSB, KGB agent. He looks at the world as a kind of chessboard, thinking about all kinds of ways and tactics, it seems to me, with the mindset of an intelligence agent, about how to deal with his adversaries and cause as much dissension as he can between America and its own allies. And ransomware, these private hackers, which operate with a large measure of impunity within Russia, but certainly can be constrained and controlled if Putin wanted to do so, are the latest tool. They've been up and running now for years. And we need to keep in mind, I would argue all of these warnings to Putin have proven to be, frankly, quite hollow. This has been on Putin's radar screen. The president put it there since the beginning of this year. He put it on the radar screen again. You've seen one of the largest global ransomware attacks in the last week or so. There was another phone conversation with another warning from the president. And, you know, U.S. intelligence will monitor this for the next week or two to see whether or not Putin cools this down. But I'm increasingly persuaded that a U.S. response has to be forthcoming. And while we undertake that response, we have to understand that we also live in a glass house. I don't know how many of our power, gas, and water companies are private sector and are not up to having the sort of defenses, cyber defenses, and basic security provisions that protect protect their systems, but too many. So the response has to be proportional, but it also has to send an unmistakable message. And I think that's going to be very hard. Vladimir Putin is determined, I think, ultimately, to reassert in any way he can the fact that Russia is not a fading power. It must remain central to American calculations. He's also trying to settle a debt for the expansion of NATO, which I think was a major mistake by previous administrations, and to demonstrate that Russia has regional reach. So the notion that there's going to be a reset, the notion that there'll be some sort of transformation in the U.S.-Russian relationship, I think is fantastical thinking. There may be issues, Jennifer, in which we can cooperate, nuclear counter-proliferation efforts, climate, the pandemic, but any fundamental change that is going to put the U.S.-Russian relationship on a stable track, I think, is almost out of the question. A former colleague of mine at Carnegie, calls both our relationships with Russia and China managed enmity. And I think, frankly, I wish it weren't the case, but I think that may be the best we're going to get in the period ahead.
And you're right that even though it seems as though many in this administration and around the country view Russia and China as existential threats, you say no, they're not.
I don't think that either one presents a, and I use the word existential, words are very important to me, and I use it willfully, an existential threat to the United States. We are in an extraordinary fortuitous position as a country. We have non-predatory neighbors to our north and south who do not threaten the United States. And we have fish to our east and west. What one historian, I wish it had been me, brilliantly called our liquid assets. These two oceans and these non-predatory neighbors give us an advantage that no other country, none, that ever existed in the international system possessed. Most countries are dominated by history and geography. To a large degree, the United States has freed themselves from these two forces. I think, and this is not to take the part of Beijing or Moscow, they are serial human rights abusers. They are trying to, clearly the Russians meddle in our elections. The Chinese have their own imperial objectives. But if you ask me who or what is the greatest existential threat to the United States, we need to take a long look in the mirror. And therein lies the answer. And we need to understand that.
We'll go to Fred, who's calling from Arousic. Hi, Fred, go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to ask Mr. Miller how he sees the potential and the prospects for a recovery of the role of diplomacy, and namely how the State Department is recovering or can recover from 4 years of a president who tried to tear it apart and demean the role of diplomacy with all these terrible, difficult problems facing the United States, despite the need to focus on the home front. We do need a vibrant and effective foreign service. And after 4 years of Trump, just interested how he sees the chances for recovery.
It's a very good question. Very good question. And I would only say that I've worked for Republicans and Democrats, and I voted for Republicans and Democrats. So you can take this as a partisan comment if you wish, but it is not an intended as one. The last 4 years has been a willful effort on the part of the previous administration to hollow out not just the Department of State. Mike Pompeo, arguably, while not the shortest tenured Secretary of State in the modern history of the United States, that distinction belongs to Rex Tillerson, in my judgment, has been probably the worst. It's not it was not just an attack on American institutions and on the Department of State and on diplomacy. It was an attack on the very nature of public service, the sort of selflessness and tethering your career to a set of objectives broader than you are as an individual that was seemed to be the operating dynamic of the previous administration. It was, to use my phrase, an inability to turn the M in me upside down, so it became a W in we. And I think you saw hollowing out. Applications in the Foreign Service, I think, are down. Many appointments were not made at the mid-level, which meant there was no mentoring, no guidance for young Foreign Service officers. I think that there's been a fundamental change on the part of the Biden administration. One of my close friends, Bill Burns, is the director of Central Intelligence. He's the first career diplomat, I believe, to be chosen as CIA director. And it was done, I think, to essentially highlight the importance of diplomacy. And you talk to any military man or woman, and they will continue to assert that a strong diplomatic enterprise, a strong State Department of State is critically important to their work in order to preempt, to constrain, to avoid the projection of American military force when it may not be necessary.
Go ahead.
No, I just think that it's going to take time to rebuild. Tony Blinken is a product of that system. I think he's ideal for this particular role. But even more important, I think the president really understands that to be respected and admired in this world, not just to be feared. And the last time we were feared, respected, and admired, in my judgment, was George H.W. Bush and his very able secretary, James Baker, for whom I had the honor of working. To be respected and admired, we can always be feared as a consequence of our military power, which is awesome and formidable. But respect and admiration comes, I think, in part with the hard work, very difficult work of diplomacy. And last point, that does not mean that every problem out there has a diplomatic solution. In fact, I divide the world right now, Jennifer, into root canal operations on one hand and migraine headaches on the other. I don't see huge opportunities to come to transformative conclusions with Russia, with China, in Syria. But as one of my former bosses, George Shultz, made clear, tending the garden, doing real diplomacy is critically important, not only to solving problems and laying the basis for their solutions, but gaining a measure of respect and admiration and listening to other countries who, frankly, even though sometimes we're reluctant to admit it, actually have legitimate interests too.
I've read or heard that there's a surge of applications to the State Department, Aaron. Have you heard that as well?
No, I've heard the opposite, and I hope I'm wrong. I think it's going to take a while to rebuild. A lot of that is driven by I suspect, and I'm hoping you're right that the numbers actually have substantially increased, particularly in the wake of COVID. Now that we seem to be transitioning into something, well, a new, let's leave it at this, a new normal, whatever that means.
Well, Fred, thank you so much for calling in. And if you have a question for Aaron David Miller or a comment about anything going on in the world, in the U.S. policy towards that, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. We'll be right back. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Fallbrook Woods, a Maine-owned assisted living community in Portland, supporting the unique needs and individual styles of those with memory impairment. Fallbrookwoods.com. by Hardy Boat Cruises in New Harbor, offering puffin watches with National Audubon Naturalists. More information at hardyboat.com. And by the Marvin Design Gallery by Eldridge Lumber in Portland, a Marvin retailer providing windows and doors, committed to helping people live well in their homes.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. 40 years ago, a small studio out of Japan released an arcade game called Donkey Kong. It would go on to create a generation of gamers, and on the 40th anniversary of its debut, we'll speak to the first player to ever score a million points next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us. Here and Now upcoming shortly at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. Not only is Maine Public Television available free over the air, it's also streaming live at mainepublic.org. You can enjoy all of your favorite PBS and Maine Public Television programs and even discover new favorites throughout the day. Check it out at mainepublic.org/live TV. And if you're without internet, you can still access Maine Public's 4 television stations over the air with an HD TV antenna. To learn more about Maine Public Television over the air and for helpful information on choosing your antenna, please visit mainepublic.org. Free access to Maine Public Television is made possible through the generous support of our members. Consider becoming a member today to help us deliver this great service to our neighbors throughout Maine, and thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling. Today we're talking about international affairs and the Biden administration. My guest, Aaron David Miller, who is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He has written a number of books, including The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email, if you're quick, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to Facebook or Instagram. Aaron David Miller, you've spent a great bit of time in your career focusing on the Middle East. We haven't really even talked about that yet. Israel has a new prime minister in an unusual coalition agreement. My understanding from what I've read, Naftali Bennett, right wing for a couple years and then an opposition leader for the 4 years after that. Explain to us what that means for Israel and what it means for U.S. policy.
Now, this is the fourth election that the Israelis have conducted in 2.5 years, which indicates a severe sort of dysfunction in their political democratic system. It's intriguing to me that the reason Benjamin Netanyahu, until last month, the longest governing prime minister in the history of the state of Israel, was defeated, was not because he was faced by some charismatic or powerful candidate. Naftali Bennett has 6 seats in a Knesset of 100, an Israeli parliament or Knesset of 120. He's a minority in a minority without precedent, I think, in Israel's political history. Nor was Netanyahu defeated by some new philosophy or fundamental change. His party, the Likud, still, in my judgment, represents the dominant right-wing sort of bent of the Israeli public. He was defeated because his rivals and his enemies made a calculation that the continuing of his prime ministry would fundamentally and negatively affect the political and economic interests of the country, and that it was time for a change. And the 3 right-wing parties that comprise this government, all the heads of those parties, including Naftali Bennett, have been abused, wronged, and undermined at some point in their political careers. All of them worked for or with Mr. Netanyahu. So this, in many respects, was an anomaly even more. Now, the average length of an Israeli government since independence is roughly 1.8 years. I'm arguing that this government probably will last at least 2 years, maybe longer, in large part because none of them, including the left that is part of the government, and for the first time in Israel's political history, a Palestinian party representing Israeli citizens, 20% of Israel's population are Palestinian citizens of Israel. none of these parties want to see Mr. Netanyahu, who will remain formidable in opposition, come back to power. Whether anything can get done in this with his government, and I would argue strongly when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, very little will get done, is another matter. But I think for Israelis, this represents an opportunity to address internal problems and repair some of the institutional damage that the previous prime minister has done.
Let's turn to Iran, a new incoming prime minister there as well, who has already stated not interested in discussing the Iran nuclear deal. What is the fate of the deal?
You know, that's another fascinating question. And the Vienna negotiations, which would be entering their seventh round when they resume, if they resume, suggest that this new Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, represents an even harder line view than his predecessors. I think that Iran wants relief from sanctions, but I'm not entirely persuaded that they're eager in the last several months would support this, to somehow quickly rush back into this agreement. They've created a sort of resistance economy. They developed new and deeper relations with the Chinese and the Russians. Iran is hurting, or at least the Iranian public is hurting. But I think, and frankly, if you ask me, Mr. Biden, political interests are not going to be served by return to this agreement because, you know, as I sit here looking out of my window at the District of Columbia, I think to myself, with the exception of a few progressive Democrats, maybe, and some think tankers, there's not a whole lot of margin in this town if the agreement is reached. The Republicans hate it. Mainstream Democrats, several very influential Democrats, have been very critical of it. And most of the American public really doesn't care. I think it's potentially important because I can't see another way to at least constrain or restrain the Iranian nuclear program. It's a highly flawed agreement originally. It's probably still going to be flawed, but it's semi-functional if your objective is to prevent an Israeli-Iranian confrontation, which is clearly possible, into which the United States will be drawn. Any war in the Middle East right now, Jennifer, is going to lead to falling markets, economic markets, and rising oil prices, which is something this president does not need.
We'll go to David calling from Berwick. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Just listen to the ambassador you had on earlier talking about how American influence in these other, well, Haiti in particular, there was more of the problem than the solution. And I remember, you know, it was Zbigniew Brzezinski with the Carter administration. We needed to fund Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen. And on and on and on. Talks about Trump foreign policy. I'm 57. It's the first time in my lifetime that we had a president who did not escalate war in other countries. Obama annihilated Libya. Libya had the highest standard of living in the continent of Africa before we went there. Our foreign policy all over the globe has been a complete failure for years. And nobody's held accountable. These so-called experts are embarrassing. The problem with this country is from within. Thank you.
Aaron.
Well, I would only say to the caller, I'm 72. And, you know, I may be one of those failed diplomats or experts to which he's referring. And I quite agree with the last comment that the greatest challenge that this country faces is from within. But again, having worked for Republicans and Democrats and having voted for Democrats and Republicans, you know, I cannot, and Collar didn't explicitly say this, but I think he clearly implied that the Trump foreign policy was somehow an innovative success. I just don't see it that way. I think in part, the president, through his domestic actions and his toying with American institutions and his unpresidential behavior, undermined American influence at home and contributed to the fact that the United States was less respected, less admired, and with some exceptions, certainly not feared. I don't understand how the China policy has made things better, and I don't understand how the maximum pressure campaign against Iran, which has only advanced and accelerated its own nuclear program, made things better either. Plus, even though I do not believe that human rights and democracy has ever occupied a central place in American foreign policy, I don't believe that emptying the frame of American foreign policy of any moral or ethical value, which I believe Mr. Biden's predecessor helped to bring about, serves American interests. I quite agree, and I think we need to understand we are not the quote unquote indispensable power. If indispensable power means we need to be available whenever something goes wrong to address it, to fix it, that we need to be there. You know, de Gaulle, the late French president, famously said that the cemeteries of France were filled with indispensable people. We can't be indispensable, not given our broken house. We have interests, they need to be protected, but we need to be prudent extremely disciplined in how we go about protecting them. And I don't see that the last 4 years have brought us much closer to that objective on most of the challenges we confront in the world.
An email here from Kenneth. Do you see the exit of Benjamin Netanyahu from leadership as an opportunity for diplomacy? If yes, how?
If the emailer is talking about the Israeli-Palestinian issue, the answer would be, a resounding no. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict continues because there is insufficient leadership on both sides. There's insufficient ownership on both sides. I just would remark that all of the breakthroughs that occurred in this conflict occurred without the participation of the United States. Israel-Egypt, Israel-Jordan, Israel-Palestinians during the failed Oslo process. All of that happened because the parties themselves, for their own interests and their own reasons, decided that they needed to change the situation. So you don't have the kind of leadership you need, even with Mr. Bennett, or certainly on the Palestinian side. You don't have that sense of ownership that leaders are willing to take this on in a sort of heroic way. And finally, because you don't have those two things, no American president should throw themselves into this problem, because they will ultimately not succeed. And what we don't need, having failed so many times during the course of my involvement in this process, in part, partly because of bad advice that we offered to a series of secretary of states and presidents, partly, what we don't need is another failure. Because in the end, failure costs. I remember what Bill Clinton said to us before we went to the Camp David summit in July of 2000. You know, he said, trying and failing is better than not having tried at all. And, you know, I spent a lot of time at the University of Michigan. Trying and failing is better than not having tried at all is okay if you're the Wolverines, University of Michigan football team. That's a perfectly appropriate slogan. It is not an appropriate slogan for the most consequential country on earth, the United States. Because every time you fail, you lose something. Success is the world's most compelling ideology, and failure generates the opposite. So no, I do not believe that Mr. Netanyahu's departure will open up new opportunities that are going to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. They may offer up an opportunity or two to better manage this. But until you have leaders that are willing to stand up and risk on both sides, Jennifer, we're going to be having this conversation next year too.
We're going to go to Doug in Booth Bay Harbor. Doug, we're getting tight on time, so if you could ask your question quickly, that would be great. Go ahead. Okay, so I think we'll go away from Doug and we'll go to Jonathan, who writes on email, realistically, what options does the U.S. have to let Putin know enough is enough regarding election meddling and or cyber crimes? Does Aaron believe the U.S. has the capability to inflict damage on Putin and Russia? And is U.S. cyber capability robust enough to shut down some vital Russian systems to let Putin know he's paying a price?
I mean, I'm no expert on cyber command, to say the least, but I believe in answer to the emailer's question, yes, we have the capacity and capability, I would think. To quote Garry Kasparov in the New York Times the other day, the world chess champion, former world chess champion, go after the banks, not the tanks. Do I think we have the capability to begin to freeze and empty bank accounts of key Russian oligarchs who are supporters of Mr. Putin or Mr. Putin himself? We probably do. If Russian private hackers have the potential to shut down colonial systems, its back office systems, which force Colonial to shut down its entire pipeline system. That week I was driving on Wisconsin Avenue, and for the first time since 1974, I saw gas lines at gas stations. That was done by hackers. Yeah, we have the capacity to inflict major damage on Russian systems. The real question is, I come back to the glass house problem. We're not an authoritarian country. The state does not control all of the basic systems. They're in the hands of the private sector, but unfortunately, we're not equipped to deal with the counter response. I don't think. And that therein lies the problem of the glass house. And you know what they say about people in glass houses not throwing stones? Well, it makes sense. So it's a bind. It's a real bind.
As always, such a pleasure to have you on the program. That's Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace and global affairs analyst for CNN and other major news outlets. Thanks, Aaron. Today's sound engineer, George Thomas. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Tomorrow on the program, we will discuss ransomware attacks and also answers to your personal technology questions and security. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.